Let's start with Nuland's departure. In your opinion, everybody's happy about that. How did you find it? Do you think there were some sort of disagreements within the Biden administration that led to this resignation or firing?
I think Victoria Nuland's departure is more mundane. I wish I could say it was over her failure or whatever. They are manifest. But I think it was all about Kirk Campbell and her and the competition for being Deputy Secretary of State. And Kirk got the nod and she didn't. Now, you could say, and I think rightfully so, that one of the reasons she didn't get the nod is that she had not been singularly successful in the policy she pursued and persuaded others to pursue. Dramatically bad there. But Kirk got the job. I'm not too excited about Kirk being there either, because ever since he left CNAS, the Center for New American Security, the think tank now that sort of gestates Democrats for administrations, ever since he left there, he's gotten really hardcore about Taiwan. So I'm waiting to see what happens, but I'm not sure I'm comfortable with Kirk being Deputy Secretary of State any more than I would have been with Victoria, although he's not quite the neoconservative lapdog that Victoria was. Well, the image that immediately comes to mind is rats deserting a sinking ship. And I think that's a very apt metaphor for people like Breedlove, Philip Breedlove, the Air Force general that sort of started a lot of this with his Harley Davidson and his leathers, four-star general riding down into Ukraine to deal with the Azov battalion and other unsavory characters like that, way back there when, to Victoria Nuland. You're going to see, I think you might not see it because they have a tendency, unlike rats climbing down the anchor chain, for example, they kind of just disappear into the think tank woodwork. And so you have a hard time spotting them as they abandon ship. But nonetheless, I think you're going to see quite a few people who are identified with and cheerleaders for this support of Ukraine against Russia, kind of leaving the structure because they have failed and failed catastrophically.
Do you think that would affect Zelensky's position? We know that recently Zelensky, in an interview with Fox News, said that Ukraine doesn't have plan B, a backup plan. Do you think that this support that is already gone would bring some sort of sanity to Zelensky and his administration?
I like to think that Victoria had to carry as her last primary mission some really difficult message for her to carry, which was, and they felt like she would be the best one to do this. After all, she was the warmonger, and now let her be the ostensible peacemaker. I think she had to carry the message to him that he had to change, that he had to, if he wanted to continue to have Washington and NATO's ultimate support, he had to change. He had to be more open. Maybe even he had to rescind that very stupid move he made with saying it was illegal to negotiate with Russia. Anybody negotiating with Russia was illegal. And that didn't work. So that may be the last era, a fatal era, if you will, for Victoria. I've heard rumors to that effect. I can't confirm them, but she didn't deliver the message anytime, really, but she certainly didn't deliver it at that time. But that is the message. If Zelensky cannot, maybe as a ceremonial move to indicate to Putin that he's now willing to talk, get rid of that, however you do it, he's got to do something. Otherwise, we need a new leader in Ukraine. We need a leader who's looking after Ukraine and looking after its fundamental interests, and that means neutrality, no NATO membership, a ceasefire negotiated as fast as possible, a DMZ, perhaps UN troops in the DMZ in the interim while they do the peace negotiations. And we know, I don't think the Russians will be as irascible as the North Koreans were, but we know they took 3 damn years to negotiate things that needed to be negotiated. I think with the Russians, you could do it in 6 months, and you need to do the things that you need to do. And we've talked about those before. I could make a list up, and I could probably go as the U.S. ambassador, and I could meet with Sergey, and we could probably get it done in a week. But it won't happen that way because Biden isn't the kind of guy who does that sort of thing. And he's going to, this is all about his prestige now, not to mention his electability. If he's seen as cutting and running and not putting up a real good fight in whatever negotiations might evolve, if they do, I hope, then he's going to lose more points. I'm told when I had to work with the Transition Integrity Project and with the huge task force we set up to make sure the 2016 election was fair and decent, I got a lot of insight into the heads of the Democratic and the Republican parties, all the bad warts and the good things. And what I saw there was a real tendency to back away from and push the president, rightfully so, probably, politically speaking, domestically politically, from things that just would shave off votes so fast you couldn't keep up with them. Well, one of the things that's doing that for Biden right now, massively so, is Gaza. Not that those people will go vote for Donald Trump. What they will do is not vote. Or they'll, you know, they'll, in some states, I understand they're going to have a ballot preference for, I do not want to vote for anyone, whatever that might be indicated. So 100,000 a week, that's a lot of voters he's losing. That's what the head of a particular group in the political party told me, whom I have a lot of respect for. And Ukraine, if he were to be perceived as cutting and running from that, might shave some more off. So as I said to a friend of mine in New Hampshire this morning, we're looking at the possibility of a no-choice election, a distinct possibility of a no-choice election. We might have 50% of the American voters go out there and vote holding their nose, and then this kind of Supreme Court-like adjudication of whatever happens in that respect, because it probably is going to be very, very close if that's the way it goes. I don't think either side wants that. But I think we're going to get that because of the doom coughs on both sides.
People who are criticizing this manner of the Biden administration for not seeking some sort of negotiations, because it can get worse, as we saw in Afghanistan, in Iraq. There Yes. is no point if the conflict gets to a point that nobody's willing to negotiate. That's going to be worse. It seems that we are approaching that point, and there is no understanding in the current administration.
Well, I think you're right. You know, I was just rereading a really excellent history of the period before, during, and after the Soviet Nazi Entente. Remember when Stalin sent the last signal to Hitler? The last signal was to fire his Jewish foreign minister, fired him and got rid of him. And Hitler recognized that. Oh, Joe is telling me he wants an alliance. And all of a sudden you had this flip around. It was so swift that you had communists in France and elsewhere who went and wept because old Joe had signed up with Adolf. And they didn't know what to do. They were running around like chickens with their head cut off for weeks because they didn't know what to do, didn't know what it meant. Well, they had a term that they developed. The NKVD, actually some of their operatives put this term in use, but it was used by Pravda journalists and others as a slang. It was the Russian term was Chernyaya Grayas, I think it was. It meant gray mud. And you can get the connotation there. That's what you did to reality in order to obscure what was underneath. We have more of that around today than you can shake a stick at, from the Washington Post, from the New York Times, from the London papers, from Berlin, from Paris. We have all this gray mud being flung out at everybody. So it's very difficult to get a handle on what is really happening. I feel sorry for anybody who has to be a serious negotiator. We need them. We need them seriously. We need them in there now doing it. But there's been so much Chernyaya Grayas thrown out there that it's very difficult to see where the truth lies on either side. So, but certainly on Washington's side. You first need, as we said, you first need to have a new leader in Kyiv. And he needs to be interested in saving the rest of his state, in saving the lives of Ukrainians, and in bringing back as many as the Ukrainians he can, and in establishing a peace agreement that will allow the EU, Russia, the United States, and others to rehabilitate his country over a decade or two, because that's how long it's probably going to take, and perhaps even prepare them for European Union membership if the European Union doesn't fracture and fall apart in that time. So this is hard work, very hard work. At the same time, as you know, we've got to deal with no nuclear weapons treaties. We've got to get away from these things that are distracting us and get towards the bigger things that are going to kill us all. So there's a lot on the plate of any leader today. And I just don't think Zelensky has shown, though he's shown great courage, valor under fire, other things, I just don't think he's now the man for the job.
We know that Emmanuel Macron said that there is no limit for us to support Ukraine. And at the same time, when he was getting radical toward this conflict, we had Olaf Scholz saying that we know we are not going to send anybody to Ukraine to fight Russians. The German parliament as well said the same thing. And we know that German Bundeswehr were talking about targeting the Crimean Bridge. What's happening in Germany when you look at Germany? It seems a total mess. You don't know who's in charge in Germany.
I think you're right. You don't know who's in charge in Germany. And I don't think the chancellor knows who's in charge either. He certainly isn't. And the SDs are certainly not in charge. They might be figuratively in charge, but that's not who's really directing helter-skelter Germany right now. Probably the most influential force is the abandonment of the manufacturing sector by manufacturer after manufacturer and the complete change of the German economy. That's devastating Germany. And I think it's going to have some really deleterious results. But as to Macron and anybody else that would make statements like that, I'll use Condoleezza Rice's phrase, which I hated when she said it, but it's very apt now. Do you want the warning to be a mushroom cloud? Because that's what you're talking about, President of France. If you're talking about putting major NATO support in terms of airplanes and people, even special forces on the ground in Ukraine, you're talking about starting World War III.
Larry, how much of this strange behavior of European leaders came from Nuland?
I think the pressure has been constant, and it's been from different places, but all aligned with the same philosophy. And it started really back before we even came into the State Department in 2000. It started maybe in the middle of Bill Clinton's term. And what it involved was capturing, let me back up for a moment. There were some really fair estimates on the Joint Staff, and the Joint Staff at that point, after Goldwater Nichols, had become, in my estimation, the premier military staff in the world, the premier general staff in the world. I would rank it right up there with the German staff in World War II in the beginning. And there was plenty of study that said, hey, the alliance structure is going. It's going to be gone. Japan, Korea, Australia, ANZUS is gone pretty much for all practical purposes. We've tried to band-aid it, but so we need to start thinking about things. So one of the things we were going to think about really hard was a European security identity and a European force to go along with that identity. First, to be created by the Europeans independent of NATO. It would not pull troops from NATO. If it had to act within Europe, the Balkans comes to mind, for example, in the 90s. If it had to act in Europe, it would act separate from NATO under the Europeans, whatever structure they decided to put up. Well, they backed out of that. They didn't want to do it. They didn't want to commit the troops. They didn't want to spend the money or anything. Well, what happened then was we fell into that gap, some of us, a lot of neoconservative. Steve Bannon fell into that gap. And we started going to European capitals and doing things like trying to get people into the political system who agreed with us about, at this point, just taking on Russia, ultimately. And we began to get people elected. That's how we got Jens Stoltenberg. We groomed him to be the NATO Secretary General. Bannon groomed Viktor Orban. Bannon groomed other people in Europe that were extreme right wing, but they didn't get elected. I think he tried with Le Pen in France, but I'm not sure he was successful there. I don't know whether he had anything to do with Italy or not, but I know he was there. So he was around spreading this philosophy. And then there were other people in the government who were doing this too. There were diplomats who were working on this, getting the idea into Norwegian heads, Swedish heads, and other heads of holdouts during the formal NATO initial process to come into NATO. That's what we have now. 32 countries now, as unwieldy as you could possibly get. But that's what we were doing. And the real effort underneath that, go back and read George Bush's 2002 national security strategy. The real impetus for that was to reestablish full American hegemony over Europe. Real American hegemony, economic, diplomatic, military, period. We were going to do it. We felt like we were going to lose it, and we might even lose the alliances, which I think was an accurate projection. So that's what's been going on underneath the covers that nobody talks about. No president has articulated that. No secretary of state has articulated that. Certainly not Steve Bannon's plans, because Bannon's plans were, you know, sort of like Donald Trump, make Hungary great again, make France great again, that sort of thing. But these are different schisms, if you will, of the same general approach. We want to have hegemony over Europe, most important place on earth. We can't lose it. And now we're paying the piper for those miscreant actions, in my view.
When it comes to NATO, recently Biden said that NATO is stronger.
I still maintain that it won't be here very shortly from now. And I believe we've lost the transatlantic link ultimately. I thought it would probably happen after I passed away, but if I live another 5 or 6 years, I might get to see it. Not that I want to see it, but I might get to see it. It's just too fractious. It can't hold. The center can't hold even. Germany can't hold. Wither Germany, wither NATO. I just don't see it staying together with any cohesiveness. The only reason, this is what I contend, is Putin's one big strategic error. Geostrategic era. NATO was going to fall apart of its own, you know, whatevers, just like the Soviet Union did. And he went ahead and invaded Ukraine, and I don't think he lacked motivation for that for a minute, but he did it on a what I would call a sub-strategic level. And he wasn't thinking about what the signs were from Berlin, London. I mean, Brexit alone should have given him, no matter whether he had anything to do with it or not, if he had something to do with it, say 1-2% of the vote, which some people think he did, then why did he back off that strategy? The better strategy was a non-military one, just like with the Soviet Union. Remember Kennan's prediction about the Soviet Union when he sent the long telegram back to Washington? He essentially said all the United States has to do is live up to its values, keep its economy strong, and the Soviet Union will collapse. You don't have to do all this domination crap, you know. And Eisenhower was influenced by that in the Solarium exercise. When he had the exercise and determined what containment policy would be, and he's the guy who did it, not Acheson and Truman. Acheson and Truman started out with the Bible, NSC 68, but he's the guy who put the oomph behind it. And the oomph was more or less Kennan-esque. It was, let's be ourselves and watch them fall apart. Now, president after president had to show his bona fides and build more rockets and all this other crap. But the Soviet Union, by philosophy and design, was going to collapse. And it did. Well, so is NATO.
How do you see the possibility of having a direct conflict between NATO and Russia? And what that mean for us?
Those people are going to die. Or be wounded or be disappointed and turn around and leave, like many of the people I know from the United States have gone over there. They're home now. But you're right, the potential for Putin getting angry and maybe even deviating from what his ultimate purpose is here, which is to simply get a piece of Ukraine that has Russians living in it and deal with it. Have a bigger objective. As I've said many times, you know, war has a dynamic of its own. And if you, I should say that, and one of the things Clausewitz talks about is you can never chop the political aspect, the political leadership, the policy from the actual execution of the strategy. They're always connected and they're always tugging at each other and changing each other as they go along. As I've said, Putin may just decide, well, hell, I'm in for a penny. I'm going in for a pound. I think I'll take Odessa. I think I'll take the whole southern Black Sea border of Ukraine, and maybe I'll link up over there at the other side with those Moldovans or whatever. And, you know, I'm pissed now because you won't negotiate. I said I would stop. I said I would do what I wanted to do and get it done, and then we could have a peace agreement. But you won't stop. So I'm going to keep going. And then you prompt something from the other side, like you're talking about. And then you prompt World War III. That's the reason this thing needs to stop now.
CIA Director William Burns said that if we don't provide Ukraine with more ammunition, with more weapons, they're going to lose a huge chunk of their territory. We know that in Ukraine, there are some...
Why? Ask yourself why. Because we haven't stopped. Bill Burns' testimony yesterday, the portions I heard of it, William Burns lost me, left me. No longer have respect for William Burns. I hate to say that because he was the only true diplomat left in the Biden administration. But his testimony was a joke.
When they're talking about sending more weapons to Ukraine, who's going to use these weapons? Where is the manpower?
Well, these are acts of desperation. And I can attribute them to, and with some validity, and perhaps even I could prove them if I took enough time, Joe Biden's desire to not be perceived domestically as cutting and running until the percentages line up. And then he will have no problem shutting down the Ukraine theater if it's still shuttable down. But that's it. It's domestic political interest. It's, I can't do this because it won't be reelected. And let me say this too. He's got to be recognizing that he is in a real possibility of being beat. He's in 8 months ago, 10 months ago, 12 months ago, I never would have said this. He is designing his own coffin, political coffin. He's designing the loss of a second term with what he's doing in Gaza in particular, but the Ukraine conflict is increasingly doing that too. These recognitions for Americans often come late. They come 3 to 4 to even 6, maybe even 9 months after they should have come. Like, for example, the recognition that we'd been in Afghanistan for far too long and something needed to be done about it. Well, Biden acted on that. He acted incompetently. And his military acted incompetently, but nonetheless, he acted on it. But that was after 20 years. In this case, I think the realization is going to strike home pretty fast, especially about Gaza. And so there's a real chance that he's not going to win this election, a real chance. And I never would have said that 6 months ago, that Donald Trump could carve himself out a pathway back to the Oval Office was risible 6 months ago to me. It no longer is. And it's mostly because of Joe Biden. It has nothing to do with Trump and what he's done to improve his position. If anything, his position has deteriorated. But Biden has murdered himself.
If Trump wins and stops supporting this conflict in Ukraine, do you think that Europeans can support Ukraine to continue this conflict?
No, I don't for a moment, because they'll fall out amongst themselves almost instantly. And you'll have the Orbans and the Macrons and the, whoever replaces the chancellor in Germany arguing predominantly. And then you'll have the Scandinavians wondering why the hell they came into this fractious bunch of bobos. And then, as I've said, the alliance will start to fall apart around everybody's ears. And Washington will be there, you know, with the baton raised over the International Symphony Orchestra and, ooh, what's happening? But we won't have anybody to raise the baton. Don't for a minute think that Donald Trump will act on anything that he said he would act on if he gets back in the Oval Office. Donald Trump will put a crowd of people around him who this time he thinks he won't have to fire within the first 6 months or even shorter, who will do his bidding whenever he asks them to do his bidding. He'll put an 18-year-old in as Secretary of Defense. You know, that's sort of stupid move, but he'll do it. And he'll put people in there that are malleable and controllable, like he did towards the end of his only term to this point. And he won't live up to any of the things that he said he would live up to because he can't. The structure will fight him too hard. The structure will just say, Mr. President, try to survive for 4 years because we're not going to let you do squat. And, you know, either he turns into a dictator at that point, which is a fear I have, if he's got enough people to support him, particularly in the military, or he just does what he did last term, which is just go around glad-handing and doing, oh, kissing Kim Jong-un, whatever he wants to do, and making big money for the afterwards. That's all Donald Trump will do. I don't fear him in that sense, except that he could go down the other route where he turns into a real autocrat. And that could be disturbing because he'll have all these little autocrats around him who will be doing the same thing within each element of the bureaucracy. And they'll virtually ruin it for the next 10, 15 years. Dick Cheney did that to a certain extent. He left so many of his minions and he took them out of political appointee status and put them into civil service status, where it's really hard to fire them. Over 1,800 of them. Read Shirley Ann Warshaw's book about Cheney and Bush. And she wrote Cheney and Bush in the title for a reason. Cheney and Bush. He left these people in the bureaucracy to continue to implement the draconian policies that he had put in place. Policies that obviated the Environmental Protection Agency, forestry, fisheries, regulators who didn't have any concern whatsoever for fish or forest, but had every concern for the commercial exploitation thereof. And they're still there, many of them. Trump could do that to a big, big degree too.
When it comes to the conflict in Gaza, it seems that if Trump wins, it's going to get worse.
I think the third-party candidates here, Jill Stein and Kennedy and maybe a couple of the others that are trying, I think, you know, I watched Ross Perot pull what? I forget the percentage, but it was a sizable percentage away from H.W. Bush in 92. I watched Ralph Nader pull a percentage away from Al Gore in 2000. So now we've got several opportunities out there for people to pull 2%, 3%, and that's all it's going to take. You know, you pile it up to say 9, 10%, you may be the decider of the election. So you're right. There are alternatives out there. In addition to voting, I'm not voting. The Israelis are doing nothing to help themselves. I just parsed this yesterday. This is May Golan, who's Minister of Social Equality. Quote, I am personally proud of the ruins of Gaza, unquote. This is Orit Struck, who oversees the illegal settlement program. Quote, there's no Palestinian people, unquote. This is Ayman Odin, a member of the Knesset, speaking during the ceasefire, negative vote on the ceasefire, speaking to an Arab member of the Knesset. You will die. Your children will die. Your grandchildren will die. This is Israel. 85% of the Israelis, probably more than that, but my sources tell me 85%, support what Netanyahu is doing. They don't like Netanyahu, but they support him. And if Benny Gantz were to come in there, he would continue the same policies. This is Israel. This is what we have created. This is what we are sustaining, Joe Biden in particular. This is what we are arming. This is what we are expediting the death of thousands of civilians with. They are our tool. They are our instrument. We are as guilty as they. We should both go before the International Court for genocide. That's not a very positive picture for a president to take into a re-election.
We know that Biden recently said that we're going to have some sort of ceasefire in Gaza. And right after that, Netanyahu said, no, despite all the pressure he's receiving, he's not willing to do that. Where does this confidence come from?
I think they've started it and they can't get off the horse they mounted. That's part of it. But I also think a huge part of it, if not more than half of it, is they want to do it. They want to do it. That's the most heinous part of it. And I think Joe Biden's most heinous act, conscientiously speaking, is the fact he wants to let them do it. And that's just, to me, it's just incredible. You know, I'm looking at whether I'm going to be an amici curiae for a case where the lawyers are bringing a case of, you can't prevent us from doing this, and accusing you of aiding and abetting genocide because of the policy angle. You know, the courts are saying, we can't deal with that because it's foreign policy, and we can't deal with foreign policy. We can't adjudicate foreign policy. Well, in the brief, they actually said, we recognize Israel has the right to self-defense. Bull crap. Think about that for a minute. You only have an Article 51 of the UN Charter. You only have the right to self-defense. Hell, everything from Geneva back. You only have the right to self-defense in the sense that you are righteous. That is, you are right in that defense. What are they defending against in Israel? They're defending against people who got tired of their draconian occupation of them. They have obligations under Geneva as an occupying power. They have failed again and again and again to discharge those obligations. They don't even try to. Instead, they're dispossessing the people of their land, their homes, their cattle, their orchards, and so forth. So what is it about a right to self-defense that is prevalent here or relevant here? Nothing. Israel has no right to self-defense against people whom they have been oppressing for 30 freaking years, if not longer, under Geneva since the war, since 67. They have been the occupying power, and they have distinct obligations. Even George Bush, my president, talked about this with regard to Iraq. Colon, we have obligations as an occupying power. That's why we stayed around. Because nobody else in the administration wanted to stay around. We'd gotten rid of Saddam, let's leave. Nobody wanted to stay around, but Bush felt like, as a good Christian, he had to live up to the occupying power's obligations. And technically, he was right. Well, Israel has never felt that way. Never, not a single moment have they felt that way. So why do they have a right to self-defense?
There are some reports that Israelis have some sort of desire of keeping the northern part of Gaza and yes, not giving it back. How serious is that?
Ben-Gvir has been issuing, there are videos on YouTube, he's been issuing AR-15 type weapons that we gave him to the settlers. They don't go after the Palestinians with shovels and rakes anymore. They go after them with IDF issued weapons. And they are standing there. They are standing there waiting to go into northern Gaza and begin to do what they did in the West Bank and almost have finished in the West Bank and are doing in East Jerusalem in Gaza. They have full intention to settle Gaza. They don't want a single Palestinian to come back. It's really heartrending when you look at it. And the little postage stamp things we do, like dropping meals ready to eat from aircraft, or even this causeway we're building. Now, if they get it finished and it really puts the throughput on it that it can, and no one messes with it significantly, then it could start to relieve some of the hunger. But a day late and a dollar short here. I mean, how many people are going to die from the fact that they are malnourished and can't? We know it from Yemen. You know, I was involved in that conflict for a long time, trying to get us out of it, not support Saudi Arabia and the UAE initially. And it's just horrible what this does to you. You're so much more vulnerable to cholera and other diseases, and you're just malnourished all the time. It was a terrible situation, and we couldn't even get out of that. We got it passed in both houses, but Trump vetoed it. We just don't have a very stellar record, Nima, in the last 30 years. We have become one of the world's most despicable powers. That really hurts my heart.